Hawaii with Truth News Radio Australia on the 28th of March 2014. Welcome to another show, ladies and gentlemen. We've been off the air for a couple of weeks. I've been extremely busy, but I am now getting back into a very, very intense period of work with the show. And to kick that off, I would like to welcome to the show a very, very esteemed guest who I'm really, really honoured to have on Truth News Radio, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, American economist, former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under the Reagan administration, a columnist and a writer on so many subjects and with such a breadth and a scope of knowledge and I would say wisdom that that is almost unheard of these days. And first of all, let me just say welcome to the show, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts.
Pleased to be with you.
Absolutely. And I'd like to just begin by commenting a little, Dr. Roberts, on your kind of unique perspective on the world, because from a certain point of view, you could be described as a conservative, and you've certainly been on that side of politics, and a lot of your views do coincide with what we would call the conservative, paleo-conservative viewpoint, you might say. But you have a breadth, you have a scope that looks at issues that really transcends, I feel, the falseness of the left-right paradigm. And just to give one example of that, when the South American leader of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, died, you wrote an article about him, which was really inspiring and really really made me realize the importance of Hugo Chavez. And I was a little surprised because a lot of the writers and commentators from the right in America, of course, hated Chavez, and a lot of even the people who manage the websites and you know the avenues of media that you probably broadcast in were actually saying very, very bad things about Chavez. But you came along and you wrote an article saying that he was a great hero, the greatest South American since Simon Bolivar. Could we just begin by getting you to elaborate a little on that? Because I think it's really interesting.
Well, Chavez was an indigenous president of the country, and as everyone knows, the Latin American, South American countries have essentially been ruled by tiny Spanish elites who are always in cooperation with Washington, to the detriment of the indigenous peoples that they govern. And Chavez rose up as an indigenous president and actually represented the interests of the people instead of the narrow interests of the tiny Spanish elite. And this showed it could be done. And it's also happened in Ecuador and Bolivia. And these people have an independent voice. They're not Washington's puppets. And Chavez, of course, annoyed Washington, and they organized a coup and kidnapped him. But before they could kill him, the Venezuelans poured out into the streets in such huge numbers. And also military units. And so the Americans had to release him.
Absolutely. And
this sort of showed that the traditional governments in Latin and South America represent Washington, not their people. And I think this was a good beginning for those countries if they're able to hold on. You know, currently the United States is working to overthrow the government in Venezuela. It's sponsored all of these protests and riots.
Yeah.
So we'll see how wise the people in Venezuela are, whether they can keep control of their government that Chavez gave them or not.
Absolutely, yeah. And what is your perspective on the sort of political orientation of these independent governments in South America, which are usually defined as socialist because they've done things like they've nationalized the oil? But I've always said that I thought that that was the only thing that these people could do to rescue their people and to I guess regain control of these resources. But people who have a very strictly defined kind of libertarian conservative viewpoint tend to say, well, that's socialism, therefore it's wrong. Could you just briefly comment on that?
Well, I think what's wrong is the American imperialism that steals control over the resources and hands them to American corporations. I mean, you know, libertarians are very ideological, and they're not always very thoughtful. And they respond to ideological words. But, of course, what the real situation that they call capitalism, it's really imperialism, because the if foreign interests own the oil companies, then Venezuela really hasn't any say over its own resources. So when a government nationalizes, it's simply get rid of imperialism. And what Chavez did, instead of having all these profits go to a few, he tried to improve the life of the people there. You know, he tried to expand health care. He tried to expand education. And so I think the libertarians completely missed the boat on this. In my opinion, a great deal needs to be socialized in the United States, including the large banks,
okay,
because they are essentially independent of market discipline. We've watched now for 5 or 6 years the Federal Reserve print huge sums of money to prevent capitalism from working. I mean, if capitalism was working, these banks would have all failed.
Yeah.
So when you have a non-working form of capitalism and you claim, well, we can't do anything about it, it'll be socialism, then that's just stupid, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. You've published a book in the last year or so titled The Failure of Laissez-Faire Capitalism. Is it, have I got that right? It's
yes.
The Would you say that that laissez-faire, that's actually a term from the 19th century, isn't it? But it's do you feel that that is still what we are seeing presently in the West, is that it's still this laissez-faire capitalism, and that it is on the way out? It is going to sort of implode under its own forces?
Well, it is imploding. You see, it came in again, laissez-faire, which essentially means no government regulation.
Yeah.
And privatization of public sector assets. This had been put away under the impact of the Great Depression in the United States and of social democracy in Europe. And so the laissez-faire thing had run its course, and you still had a market economy. It was just regulated to prevent the kinds of abuses and stupidities that occur when there's no regulation. But with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the ideological free market types came to the fore, and they deregulated the financial system. And we've seen the consequence of that disaster. And they pretended that job offshoring was free trade. And so they have defended moving first world jobs out of first world countries to the detriment of first world populations.
Yeah.
And they maintain this is free trade, this is good for us. And so essentially the result of the deregulation and the sort of apologetics for jobs offshoring has been to wreck the economy. And so when I speak of the failure of laissez-faire, I'm pointing out that it was the deregulation that produced these failures. And we see the United States, despite very strong monetary and fiscal stimulus now since 2008, can't create any jobs. We see that the economy can only create low-paid domestic service jobs, that the kind of professional service jobs that university graduates would take have all been moved offshore, and where they can be done and sent in on the high-speed internet. So the economy has essentially lost the ability to increase real consumer income. So if the consumer income isn't growing, they can't rely on aggregate demand or consumer spending. You can't boost aggregate demand and consumer spending with monetary and fiscal policy if there are no jobs. So this is the consequence of this deregulation and this ideological triumph of laissez-faire. I think it's coming to an end because, like you say, the system can no longer produce opportunity for the people.
And so I'm very curious to know what you see as the solution to that. Is this something that you can, I mean, do you have a view on what should be being done? And I know it's a very complex subject, but what are the first steps? How do we fix it?
Well, actually, I don't think it can be fixed.
Right.
In my book, I point out two things that can be done, but I don't think they will be because corporations are too powerful.
Yeah.
And they've committed to offshoring. And so to try to change it, I don't think is likely. I also think the United States is on on the path of another crisis, and that is the dollar. Because you see, the dollar being the world reserve currency, this is the basis for American power, and this is what permits American financial imperialism and military imperialism.
Yeah.
And it's the way the United States has turned Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Great Britain, and all of Europe into puppet states. These are not independent countries. These are not independent governments. They all get completely behind Washington, whatever it says.
Dr. Roberts, we're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Do stay with us. I'm talking to Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. Really interesting show. Stay tuned.
Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. My guest today is Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, and we are discussing the nature of the economy and what appears to be, Dr. Roberts, you're saying, a kind of an inevitable path towards collapse. I may be stealing your words there, but you might want to just continue there from where we left off before the break.
Well, we were speaking of the role of the dollar, U.S. dollar, as world reserve currency, and how this gives Washington financial imperial power and military imperial power, because it allows Washington to pay its bills by printing money. And it's been doing this for some time, but since the financial crisis in 2008, it's been doing so at unprecedented rates. I mean, unprecedented amounts of money have been injected into the banking system, both in the United States and in Europe, Western Europe. So, in other words, the supply of U.S. dollars is growing dramatically compared to the demand for these dollars. Mm. And yet, the whole world is infused with dollars and have been since the end of World War II.
Yeah.
So when you're already holding large amounts of dollars and you watch the supply grow dramatically, at some point you wonder, why are you holding these? Because they can't possibly retain the same worth when the supply is growing so dramatically. You see, the growth of the American economy in terms of its ability to produce real goods and services is certainly not matching the growth in the paper currency. And therefore, what does this represent, this currency? If we create huge amounts of it relative to goods and services, or the ability to create goods and services, then it has to lose value. Well, at some point, this should have an effect on foreign exchange rates, and the dollar should plummet. In fact, it has been plummeting in the 21st century against the price of gold. And in 2011, it occurred to the Federal Reserve that the rapid rise in the price of gold was an indication that the dollar was not holding its value, and that this would soon spread into the foreign exchange rate currency markets. And so the Fed began manipulating the price of gold, and it does that by dumping huge amounts of naked shorts in the paper gold market, the futures market. And it dumps these huge quantities at the least opportune times of day, when the market is very thin, there's no one actually active in it, there's no liquidity at that time, and they'll dump, like in 1 minute, enough contracts to equal the entire 24 hours trade. So this then sends gold price down, it triggers stop loss orders, margin calls, that increases the sales, so they can prevent the gold price from rising. And so we have had for the last several years the very anomalous situation where the actual demand for physical possession of gold is rising strongly.
Yeah.
But the paper price of gold has been suppressed. It has fallen. They've gotten it down from 1900 to 1300.
Yeah.
And anytime it starts rising, they dump these paper shorts and drive it back down. You see, it's a funny thing. The price of gold is not determined in the physical market where you take possession. It's determined in the paper futures market.
Of course.
And so so already you can see the dollar's in trouble, that the Fed has to, I mean, this has to be strictly illegal. If you and I were doing something like this, we'd be arrested. But the Fed is the public authority, so it's not going to arrest itself. So when you see the government forced to behave in the most disreputable way, which shows no respect for markets, complete manipulation, then you know the situation's desperate for the dollar.
Absolutely. One thing is interesting is that, as you say, it's the it's the relative price of the US dollar to gold that really tells you what's going on, rather than the US dollar as against other currencies. But of course, the US dollar has kind of gone through some seesaws there in relation to other currencies, but it has recovered quite a bit in the last year or so. What is your? I mean, can I? We haven't got a lot of time left for this interview, unfortunately. But can I just? Do you have a prognosis? Are we going to see a massive collapse, like a final collapse of the US dollar, where it actually does fall in relation to other currencies as well, and the gold price shoots up to some astronomical value? Is that going to happen sometime? Do we have any idea of what the timetable is? I guess we don't. But any thoughts you might have on that?
Well, it's hard to see how it can be avoided. Yeah. Unless you can find the reason that you can print endless amounts of paper currency and it doesn't adversely affect the exchange value of that currency. So as long as all these countries are American puppet states, Europe, Japan, Australia, Canada, they get orders that if their currency starts rising with regard to the dollar, that they're supposed to intervene and buy dollars. That is, put more of their currency into the market to offset the falling price of the dollar.
I see, yeah.
Japan was ordered last year to start printing money at this massive rate to match the Federal Reserve so that the yen wouldn't appreciate strongly against the dollar.
Yeah, a similar thing happened in Australia.
So as long as Washington has these puppets that supports it, I think what may happen is the BRICS, Russia, China, Brazil, India, South Africa, will form their own separate monetary block. And so their population is half the world. So the dollar will simply be excluded from that part of the world. And I think what could also happen is the aggressiveness, the military aggressiveness of the United States toward Russia, particularly with regard to this Ukraine business, it may eventually alarm the Germans to the extent that they say they don't want to be part of this. And if the Germans were to leave NATO and the EU, and neither is in the interest of Germany, that would bust up the American control over Europe. And so that would certainly lead to a rapid collapse in the dollar. You just don't know. I mean, when you see this kind of demonization of Russia, the lies that issue continually from Washington, it's leading toward war with a nuclear power. And the Germans have already had one experience of war with Russia, and they don't want another one. So I think on the whole, the Washington hubris and arrogance and the way it demonizes countries. I mean, essentially Washington is in the process of giving Russia no alternative except war.
Yeah.
So at some point this has to dawn on Merkel that being an American puppet is not in the interest of Germany or Europe. And if the arrogance of the Americans bust up their own empire, then the dollar would go very rapidly.
And that will bring about a very different world, will it not? I mean, that will change things in ways we can hardly imagine right now.
Yes, it would. It would be the end of American financial imperialism, the end of the looting of countries by the International Monetary Fund, the end of the reign of the big American banks.
What worries me, however, Dr. Roberts, is that while that may be true, the military force with the 12 aircraft carriers and the nuclear ability to basically wipe out the planet stays in force. I'm terribly sorry, we have run out of time. Would you like to come on for one more segment? Are you available to come on for one more segment?
All right. I'll do it for you. Yes.
Thank you so much. We are going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I'm talking today to Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. We've been talking about the economy, we've been talking about the price of gold and what is going to happen globally with perhaps the collapse of the US dollar. And Dr. Roberts, you were highlighting there that that this is more or less a trajectory that we're on and that this is more or less inevitable. But the question is, what happens when the economic power of the US collapses, but their military power is still more or less at its peak?
Well, it won't be.
Right.
Because if the dollar actually collapses or just takes a substantial decline in value, the ability of the United States to pay its bills by printing money will be gone. And so it won't be able to print $1 trillion a year to support the military. And the rest of the world won't accept those dollars at anything like the current exchange rate. So it would present Washington with a budget constraint that it doesn't have when it's the reserve currency.
Right.
You don't have a budget constraint if you can simply buy up the leaders of foreign governments by making them rich. You can pay all your bills by printing money. There's no budget constraint. So the decline of the dollar would put a constraint on Washington for the first time. And since the economy is already in bad shape and people are suffering, I mean, we have 50 million Americans on food stamps.
Yeah.
And yet they've cut food stamps twice. So this is pushing them down more. All kinds of social services are being cut back. It's really a war against the poor and the less fortunate. That's what Washington is conducting against its own people. So it has a very serious internal economic situation, and that can easily worsen. So this would face Washington with serious constraints. And also, the Washington nuclear forces, they're not unique. Russia has them. China has them.
Yeah.
And so I do think that Washington is insane enough to take the world to a nuclear war. I do think they are that insane because they have this ideology of American supremacy. You know, Americans are indispensable, exceptional. Sounds like Adolf Hitler talking about the Germans. And Washington has this agenda of world hegemony. And so its aggression is directed at Iran, China, and Russia, the three countries that are in its way. And so it is a situation rife with huge risk. I would say we're in a very dangerous moment for mankind, especially with the way Washington is behaving in Ukraine and the demonization of Russia, the propaganda. And this propaganda is accepted throughout the Washington's empire, you know, from New Zealand to
absolutely
Eastern Europe. So when people believe all these lies, or whether they don't believe them or not, they go along with them. You can see forces headed toward war. I mean, what is Putin to do? He's low-key. He hasn't done anything except accept the self-determination of the people in Crimea. And this is a Russian province that should never have been put in Ukraine in the first place. That's something Khrushchev did in 1954. And there's been no Russian invasion, no annexation. These are all Washington's lies. And when you tell such blatant false lies, what is the impact on the Russian government? They say we're being set up.
Yeah.
And if you think you're being set up and you can't work with the West, then you prepare for war. And so the notion that somehow Washington will be militarily supreme, I don't think is the case. Look, Washington was unable to occupy Baghdad after 8 years.
Right.
After 13 years, it can't defeat a few thousand lightly armed Taliban in Afghanistan.
They have a lot of difficulty logistically applying their military force, don't they? The tendency now is to fall back to these sort of drone technologies that allow a lot more freedom to simply just use military force without all of that other complicated part of, you know, maintaining an occupation or anything like that. I mean, we're probably going to see an escalation of that type of military activity. Would you not agree?
I don't know. Yeah. I think it'd be very easy to block that. It only takes one atmospheric explosion of a nuclear weapon. I think the electromagnetic forces knock out all those communication systems and wipe them off the computers. So I don't really know.
Yeah.
And you can't do a whole lot of damage. These drones are, you know, they can blow up a children's soccer game or a wedding or a funeral, but they can't really, at this time, be used in a massive level. So I don't know, but regardless of the technology, if you've got huge parts of the world against you and you're trying to subdue them militarily, but you can't subdue Iraq or Afghanistan, it's not a very realistic agenda to say we're going to go to war with Russia and subdue Russia. It's just, or China. It's just not likely the case. You know, in the Korean War, China at the time was a very primitive, backward country. And the United States was victorious, had been victorious 5 years before in World War II, and yet the American army couldn't defeat these backward Chinese in Korea. So whether it's all this powerful an instrument, I don't know. I think the nuclear weapons clearly are. But once they go off, you know, that's the end of life on Earth if they get into a nuclear war. And I think that's the danger. I think Washington is capable of leading the world into a nuclear war because it keeps pressing Russia on issues that Russia can't turn its back on. It can't simply say, okay, we'll let you take our backyard away and put missile bases there and grab our naval base and persecute the Russian residents, and we won't do anything about it. There's no way any Russian government can accept what Washington is demanding. And so if Washington keeps demanding this, it has to go. Washington either has to back down and lose face or has to push it to the point of war. And so when these puppet states, Australia, Canada, England, Germany, France, they support this, they're supporting their own destruction.
Yeah.
It's the American empire is enabling the process to go toward war. And it shows the total corruption of these governments. They do not represent their people. They represent Washington.
Yeah, and it certainly demonstrates the total betrayal of my country, of the people of my country, this adherence to the American alliance, because when it all goes down, we will be left alone. We will be left completely isolated as a former, you know, puppet, a former little brother of the empire, completely on our own, and we're going to have very hostile neighbors. So I'm certainly really, really concerned about what might happen if the scenario that you're describing unfolds, where the U.S. economy collapses due to the collapse of the dollar and all these effects. The U.S. can't pay its bills anymore. I can see perhaps the decline of American military power simply because the U.S. government can't pay its bills. I guess they won't be able to pay all their employees. I mean, there's such vast numbers of people employed in the Defense Department. They're going to have trouble potentially paying all of their employees. Is that a likely scenario?
Right, and the only way they can pay them is to squeeze more the already hard-pressed American people so they get dissent at home, rebellion at home.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like Gerald Celente says, if people have nothing left to lose, they lose it.
Absolutely. And look, I'm afraid on that note, we're going to have to leave it for today. It has been really, really interesting talking to you, sir, and I do hope that we get to talk to you again.
I'd be pleased to speak with you again. Thank you for sharing your audience.
Terrific. Thank you so much. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We are just heading to break. Don't go away. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. Okay, folks, I've got another very important interview coming up today. At the beginning of the second hour, I have Dr. Tullio Simoncini, oncologist, coming on to talk about his revolutionary approach to cancer. This is something that I've only recently been made aware of through my producer, Leah Shanley, and it certainly seemed rather surprising to me and counterintuitive, and I had no exposure to this before, but it looks to me like it's something very important. The view of Dr. Simoncini, who is an oncologist with extensive background in the field, his view is that cancer is actually a form of fungus. Cancer begins with a fungus and then evolves into the tumor that we recognize as cancer, which has cellular changes in it, which are defined as cancer. And although it is well known that that fungal infections coexist with cancer, the mainstream medical view has always been that that is not in any way connected to the cancer, that just coexists with the cancer. Whereas Dr. Simoncini says, no, the fungal infection is the nucleus of the cancer. And he asserts and shows with extensive video footage that he's shot using catheters and various methods to probe into the body. He is able to demonstrate that that the tumours have the appearance of fungal infections, that they're always a white colour. And he has also examined them. And we're talking about all different types of cancers here. We're talking about bladder cancers, breast cancers, intestinal system cancers, lung cancers. Virtually every type of cancer, he says, has its origin in a fungal infection. And the way of treating that is something incredibly simple and incredibly cheap, which is actually baking soda or calcium sodium bicarbonate. And he has developed various techniques of actually infiltrating, as he says, the sodium bicarbonate directly into the areas where the tumours are growing. And sometimes that is actually quite difficult because they're not accessible from the outside of the body, and even from the inside of the body it is actually quite difficult to do. But he has actually pioneered a number of techniques and achieved incredible results. So very, very exciting interview coming up in the second hour, and do stay tuned for that. Okay, briefly now in other news, I've got some Australian topics to cover. Some news here from New South Wales. Motoring groups recommend a 20% per kilometre charge on Sydney motorists. Sydney motorists could pay up to 20 cents a kilometre under a user pays system being recommended by motoring groups to charge people for how much their car weighs, where it is, and the time of day it is being driven. A London-style congestion tax would also be part of a universal road user charging model the federal government is being asked to consider to fund. Goodness me. This is total invasion of your privacy, as well as controlling and limiting what you can do through financial means. This is really a very, very scary new piece of legislation, folks, that's coming through. And, you know, it's going to be another one of these ones that just we hear a little bit about it, goes under the radar, and then bang, it's in, you know, and suddenly it'll be legislated that that you actually have to have a GPS tracker in your car, because obviously they can't do this unless you have that device. And isn't it amazing? And there's going to be all this kind of bipartisan support for it. Everyone's going to say that it's wonderful. But, of course, there are so many ways in which it's terrible. And many of those center on the invasion of your privacy and the attempt to control people's behavior. It's, what can I say? You know, it's there, it's happening, it's unfolding right before our eyes, and we can only try to stop it by taking some sort of collective action. But I doubt we are going to be able to actually stop it. So just be aware that this is something that is on the way. It's not in here yet, but the powers that be have decided that that is the way the roads of the future will be managed. And bear in mind that under the existing system we have now, we already have a network of private toll roads, which apart from just being very expensive to use, require you to have a device in your car so it can be the card reader can read it, because they do not provide toll booths, and toll booths basically are being removed everywhere now. That part of the economy of people who used to work in the collecting tolls has just disappeared. There are no toll collectors anymore. You have to have a pass. It gets scanned as you drive through. And why is that? You know, why is that a good thing? Oh, well, it saves money. Yeah, but it saves money, but it puts a whole lot of people out of work at the same time as making it incredibly inconvenient for motorists who might have to drive through one particular route once in a blue moon, and because they don't have one of these e-cards, they can't do it without incurring potentially a fine. You do get a grace period to actually pay it, but you've got to go onto a website, and it becomes a bit of a nightmare when you're traveling in a place that you've not been before, and you've probably got a lot to do, and you suddenly go through one of these e-card tolls you didn't even know was there, and suddenly you're in it. And a quick sign flashes by as you're driving saying, oh, you can pay it on this website and you've got 3 days to pay, and you know, you're trying to drive, right? What are you supposed to do, take out a pen and write that down as you drive through? Like, it's so ridiculous. It's so insulting to people to make them do this. And this is exactly what happened to me a couple of months ago. But I did manage to navigate my way to the website, which is incredibly difficult, and I did manage to pay it, although I didn't really get a proper receipt, and I still, you know, don't know really if I might even be fined. The whole way it works is just Kafkaesque, I would say, is the word that I would use. It lacks any transparency, and you just feel you're dealing with anonymous forces, powers that express themselves through vague ambiguous messages to you and threatening you at the same time. Okay, another topic for consideration. There's been a wave of protests against the Abbott government, and it's very interesting. I've certainly indicated my loss of confidence in Tony Abbott. However, I don't have a lot of confidence in this movement that suddenly sprung up like mushrooms, like field mushrooms, because it seems a little bit too organized and a little bit too party political, perhaps, in its nature. And I'm talking about the March in March, which, it turns out, has been heavily orchestrated by GetUp.org. And as listeners will know, GetUp is not what it claims to be, a wonderful grassroots organization of people who just want to do the right thing and make a better world. It is very, very tightly connected to the political parties, particularly the union movements, the Greens and Labour. And the biggest problem with this march in March, I found, is that the whole focus of it was kind of like, we hate Tony Abbott. You know, it was really unfocused and sub-intellectual kind of content, which kind of surprised me as well, because it's like it doesn't summarize any particular point of view about specific policies. It just creates this kind of mob mentality with people basically saying, oh, you know, we just hate Tony Abbott, you know, and why? Oh, well, we just hate him. And you know, that's actually really scary when you start to see that developing. And then you find out that this supposedly squeaky clean, environmentally oriented group, GetUp, has been largely involved in organizing these protests. It makes you wonder where we might be headed, what they have in store for us. My belief is that the forces behind GetUp and Labor want to reverse the repeal of the carbon tax, and that they desperately want to depose Tony Abbott, because they know that there are other leaders from within the Liberal Party who could come forward who will support the carbon tax once again. And this is to do with massive global forces. This is to do with overarching systems of global control and tyranny. So the march in March is something that I'm very concerned about. It's not, doesn't look like democracy to me, folks. We are going to break. It is a great pleasure talking to you today. My name is Hereward Fenton, and I will be back at the beginning of the next hour with my guest, Tullio Sumuncini, to talk about how cancer is a fungus. Stay with us.